It's Saturday, 10th, 2011. We are broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KUSP Public Radio. The first half of Geek Speak will be covering geek news, and the second half, calls with questions and comments about technology. It is time now for Geek Speak.
The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI.
Join the car guys, Click and Clack, the Tappet Brothers, for their advice on things automotive and just about everything else on Car Talk, every Sunday at 9 a.m. right here on Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. And Geek Speak on KUSP is supported by Cruise.io Internet, offering commuters quiet drop-in office space with a 10 gigabit fiber internet connection at 877 Cedar Street in downtown Santa Cruz. Information is at cruise.io.com. And welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I am your host, Miles Elam. Please keep in mind that the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today's theme is by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music, and it is open for Creative Commons, share and share alike. If you want to make a theme song for Geek Speak, please send it in. If we like it, we'll put it up on air. The second half of the show, we will be inviting you to join us via phone with questions and comments about technology. The phone numbers are 800-655-5877. In the air room with me are Jordan Hart, Technical Director for Digital Media Academy. Hey, except I need to actually pot up your mic. Let's try that again.
Hey, Miles.
That's much better.
Good morning.
And Lindsay Lonnie, System Analyst.
Good morning, Miles.
And a person who will remain nameless also. Watching us.
Lurking about.
Hi, Nameless.
So let's start off with some geek news. Lindsay.
So these floods that have been going on in Thailand, I'm sure you've heard about that, but it's affecting a hard drive production. And even where I work, we're feeling this, where we've got customers expecting boxes that we normally order through places like PC Connection, Lenovo. Independent research groups are predicting that consumers are going to be affected most through February of 2012, but that the impact of these floods on hard drive production is going to decrease over the following year, but still affect us through 2013. Most suppliers are not going to be able to meet immediate demands until the second half of next year. So there's delays of like a month, 2 months in some cases for the most popular types of hard drives.
Right.
So of course,
hard drive prices have been going up instead of down. It's a really strange course of events.
Mm. Yeah. Like a month ago, some of the prices were doubling, and they're starting to decrease again now. Mm-hmm. But they're still a lot more than they were before. And so, of course, you're getting hard drives like the 5400 RPM models, which normally people don't order those, but they're the only ones that are readily available now. So if you need a computer right now, right away, you might get a strange size or, you know, a strange RPM. But Lenovo's sending out...
The backlog stock.
Right, exactly. So Lenovo's sending out notifications to their IT people as of this past week saying that 320 gig 5400, 250 gig 7200, and 160 gig 7200 are not available, and so they're substituting other things for those. And Western Digital was hit the hardest. They say that up to 75% of its production will be temporarily shut down.
And for those audience members that are not quite as geeky, they're learning through osmosis, as it were, what does 5400, 7200 refer to?
RPMs, so rotations per, what is the?
Per minute.
Per minute, yeah. And that's basically how quickly you can access data on the drive.
Right. You have a single head and then a spinning platter, and as soon as the data comes around on that spin to meet the head, that's where you read the data off.
Like an old record player. It's kind of like a stack of DVDs with an old record player reading stuff off them.
Right. So the faster it spins, the less time you have to wait for the data to come to underneath the head. Mm-hmm. And so that's why people want 7,200 RPM drives or 10,000 or 15,000 for server environments. So when you have to go back to the 5,400, it's, oh, okay, wait a little bit longer.
Right.
And this but the drives tend to be quieter.
That's true. some more silence in your drive, less vibration. I just think it's interesting that this one event is having such an impact. I mean, they're saying that global PC sales are being affected. Like, they're predicting a 9.5% growth in PC sales, and that's dropped to 6.8% prediction. That's a global statistic. It's just interesting that I didn't realize personally that so much of the hard drive production was happening in Thailand until now.
Is this affecting solid state drives as well, or is it just the spindle type, you know?
I would imagine it does, because that's where a lot of the equipment manufacturing is happening, is East Asia. Excuse me, East Asia.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if it was maybe going to give tablets even more of a lead, since they use solid state, you know, and flash RAM instead of the... But I guess if it's affecting all
of it. If I was looking at the prices, I wouldn't think that solid state was being all that much cheaper. Just because it's already pretty expensive.
That's true.
Right. If you want a lot of space, you buy a hard drive. If you want it to be fast, you buy a solid state device. If you want both, you buy both.
Right.
Yeah.
Jordan, what's your first story?
Well, Chris Dodd this week, the chair of the Motion Picture Association of America, offered some classy quotes. He compared our recent struggles here with internet piracy to China, and said that, well, hey, if China can handle censoring the internet, why can't we? Just follow their lead. In particular, he said, when the Chinese told Google that they had to block their sites or they couldn't do business in their country, they managed to figure out how to block sites. So clearly it'll work here. We should just follow the Chinese example of putting up a great firewall to protect our people from information. Obviously, I'm being facetious here. We shouldn't at all follow the Chinese example. He followed up with another quote. How do you justify a search engine providing for someone to go and steal something? A guy that drives the getaway car didn't rob the bank necessarily, but they got you to the bank and they got you out of it. So they are accessories, in my view.
Hmm. Which is a false analogy, because...
Which is a pretty terrible analogy. Yeah, it would be closer to providing the car itself. So are you going to go and are you going to sue Ford for being an accessory to the robbery?
Right. I actually kind of think of Google as the cab. You know, the cab driver comes up, someone comes into their cab, they don't know who they are, they're saying, where am I going? Okay, and drop it off.
Absolutely. You got to look at intent and motivation, and obviously Google is just trying to help people access what they want. They're not, you know, like a bank robber getaway car who's there getting a cut of the,
right,
you know, profits there, you know. Yeah.
And a related story, Kaspersky, the antivirus company, was a member of the Business Software Alliance. Those of you who are old hats in the software industry know that they've been a name that's been around for a long time. And they were the original software group of industry members that had a stake in trying to stop piracy among software, although it was back in the days when you were making sure that the 5 1/4 inch floppy had, you know, didn't have that little divot into it so you couldn't copy the floppy, you know, that type of thing. Yeah, don't copy that floppy was actually a slogan from the BSA.
Oh, wow. Don't copy that floppy.
But Kaspersky has actually withdrawn its membership from the BSA in protest over that group's support of SOPA, the Software Online Piracy Act, which is more commonly known as the...
The Stop Online Privacy Act.
Yeah. Or, I'm sorry, Stop Online Piracy. Yeah, as opposed to Software Online. And what's really curious is that you have this company that is based or founded from Russia that is going against this. And then you have a U.S. senator saying, let's be like the Chinese in terms of surveillance. It's just, it's a really mad, mad world. Like, those of you out there who are listening that remember the 80s and the movies that came out then, it was an ongoing joke at 70s, 80s on TV to say, like, the difference between us is that we have our freedoms and they don't have the freedoms in the evil empire in the Soviet Union and stuff like that. You know, we're better than China because we have our freedoms and they're being too intrusive and have a surveillance state. And having a senator or having an industry person come out and say, right, yeah, we should be more like them is a really alarming change of tactic, as it were.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Definitely some of the senators haven't been any better.
So on to more uplifting news, I hope, Lindsay.
Well, HP opens up WebOS to the open source community. That's like a big headline. WebOS, I think, was once a Palm. I don't know much about the background, so if anyone knows, feel free to pipe
in. HP bought Palm Source, yeah, which was the who made the operating system for the Palm device, but they were split off after the fact into their own division, which was kind of funny because they became the profitable one and Palm hardware became non-profitable. Right. And then HP bought them for their WebOS technology.
Good. Mm-hmm. I had a feeling you'd know about that. So the WebOS is going to live on, even though they're not going to develop it the way they have been. You know, they cut a big chunk of the team over this past year. But they plan to contribute to the open source community and foster it so that it doesn't fragment and branch off. That's what they're saying and hoping for. But I've seen other open source projects, so we'll see how that goes.
I misunderstood the reasons for that. I thought they were doing it just to get more support with it. But the idea of having it so you have a single source that people aren't trying to fork and have many different incompatible versions makes a lot more sense to me from a maintainability point of view.
Mm-hmm.
It reminds me of when BOS was out, another blast of the past for some folks. If you were into media or video editing and stuff like that, I'm sure you remember the BOS. And when that went away, there was a whole lot of people who loved the system and knew the APIs because they were very well documented, which was unusual for such a young operating system. But they just went off and tried to write their own. And people did actually write their own. It's still not quite at the quality level that the original BOS was. But that was something that happened, was you had a couple of forks of people trying to remake the system that they loved or that was, a core of their business, per se. So this makes a lot more sense to release that code to make sure that there's no incentive to try to make your own. You can all just fold the same results back into the common code base.
Right. And they're not going to prevent it, of course, if people want to do that. But it's nice that they're going to foster a central code base like that. So we'll see what happens, whether or not people do that. I mean, they're getting rid of the touchpads on eBay Fire Sale, and they're having another one on Sunday night. So on HP's eBay store, if you need a touchpad, they're going for like $99 to $149. Then you can go get the WebOS and start programming your own apps if you're into programming.
And who isn't into
right.
programming?
It's so fun.
Jordan, your next story.
Libraries are now offering up some space for hackspaces and fab labs. So a hackspace is a collective workspace for hackers and makers. You'll find everything from sewing machines to lots of computers and now these 3D printers. And a fab lab has 3D printers, which is a device that can literally print in 3D using plastics, metal, or even biological matter. They're actually printing organs now. You can print hearts and livers and whatnot.
And functional organs?
Yeah.
I hate to see that printer cartridge cost. Just
you know what's wild? They're actually talking. And this kind of surprised me.
Of organic material or rather of an actual, like what we would think of as an artificial heart. So it's
right, what you'd think of as an artificial heart. Yeah, they're making printers with tissues, using tissues. They were talking about one that had actually, this was probably early on when they were just testing it, but that actually retrofitted an inkjet printer and literally took the ink cartridge out and they put in an ink cartridge with biological matter and somehow got it to print tissues. I'm not sure if they're actually putting them into people yet, but I know they've been working on the technology for a while.
Wow. Well, why wait for the stem cells to grow into a culture to have a new organ? Just print up your own.
Yep. Control P. Liver's a little rough after, drinking last night. Time to
time for another new one.
they can all, some of them can print in metal. Those are very expensive, $10,000, $100,000. But the ones that just print in plastic are getting pretty cheap. You can make your own for a few hundred or you can buy one for about $1,000. And so they're getting very popular in these hack spaces. This article made, I think, two very intense claims. The second one I even have trouble believing. The first one is interesting. It says, the internet democratized information. 3D printers will democratize the means of production.
I actually do agree with that one. The idea that you were able to make a mock-up, especially of smaller items, like you're making some box. You don't have to go to a major plastics organization and have a whole huge batch made in order to be cost-effective. You can just say, oh, I'm going to make these prototypes, or I'm going to make this these one-offs, these like custom-made. I'm only making, you know, 50 of them. Mm-hmm. And I'm like an artist, like having a particular type of box or a lunchbox or whatever, and you don't care about the lunchbox per se, but you need this substrate to be able to draw your pictures on.
I actually saw something like that last year where they had those 3D model printers, and you can buy the plastic for it, and these artists were making these cute little salt and pepper shakers and selling them like on Etsy and places like that instead of having to outsource that, you know, to some manufacturing. They were just doing it in-house. I'm sure there's more manual labor involved, and I hate the smell of burning plastic, but, you know, it just depends on what you're willing to put up with and how much you're willing to pay someone else to make it for you or outsource. So I think that's pretty neat for artists. You can make jewelry with the metal one.
Yeah, whenever you have heated plastic, remember, folks, either outside or have a very strong fan that ventilates fresh air in.
Exactly.
Nice. And so their second major claim, and this one you may disagree with, I'd be curious what you guys think here. So they said, you know, right now it's kind of a pain. Yeah, you got to go buy this plastic. You got to feed the printer plastic, and it outputs plastic things. But they said by the end of the century, our 3D printers will be able to break down trash into component elements, store them in basically element cartridges, have a cartridge for each stable element, and then use them to print anything.
I believe that would be possible, but I'd wonder whether or not the drawbacks to that would be greater than the gains. Just because on some... I don't know if dumps. I've seen them before on turkey farms, for example. That have a huge amount of turkey offal that they need to deal with. Okay. That they've used a high-pressure reverse polymerase steam system, basically, to take all of that material and turn it back into like a heating oil or a petroleum product, and basically making extended carbon chains.
Okay.
Which is what most of our fuel is based on, extended carbon chain, you know, hydrogenated carbon chains. And at the same time, that process requires that you burn fuel in order to get those heats and pressures, which means that you're letting off a bunch of CO2. And then you're going to burn that fuel, which is going to give more CO2. Whenever you make some process, there's always going to be some byproduct. And a lot of times when you're working with organic materials anyway, it's that byproduct tends to be a CO2 or a, you know, carbon, oxygen, nitrogen.
So what can we do with CO2?
We can make the world warmer.
Yeah. Reduce our heating bills. So you're telling me that I'm not going to get a kitchen compactor that I can put everything in, and that it's going to spit out chunks, like square pellets of, you know, aluminum and compost and plastic that I can use in my printers? Because that's what I want.
Well, aluminum, this is just like the public service announcement version of GeekSpeak. Aluminum is really great, and you should absolutely recycle those to the aluminum cans. If you put them into the waste bin to go to the dump, it's a horrible waste of resources, because melting down an aluminum can to reform it into some other aluminum is so much less energy intensive than taking aluminum ore and making the aluminum and refining the aluminum in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
It's a huge amount of energy, but melting aluminum and taking out some minor, you know, paint, not that big of a deal.
Uh-huh.
So remember, recycle that aluminum. Glass is another thing. Just melting glass is not, I mean, it's highly reusable.
Yeah, and I could get my chunk of glass from my kitchen composter and go to my glass printer and make a wind chime.
And I keep meaning to have an environmental scientist come onto the show to talk about paper. Because I've always wondered, when you're printing out newspapers, for example, which along with diapers ends up being one of the biggest landfill piece of landfill material out there. I'm wondering, you're taking that carbon from trees and then you're burying it. Is that a good thing? But at the same time, cutting down those trees and then having going through the whole paper process and all of the machinery that it takes to slice those trees and press it into paper and then bleach it and you know, then print on it again, sure seems like it would either diminish that or override the gains that you would get from that. But I still wonder about, like, is it a good thing that we're burying all the paper?
What else would you... Yeah, it's like, what else would we do?
As opposed to letting it decompose, because then the decomposition would give off CO2 in an oxygenated environment.
Well, when you bury things in landfill, don't they decompose?
Yeah. No, and in general, they don't. When you put stuff into a landfill, it's a generally anaerobic environment. And one of the things they try to do is stop decomposition because you're going to get an excess of methane coming off of these fields, at least with organic material. And so if you go digging inside of a landfill that has some age to it, you can find newspapers from, say, the 60s or 70s that are perfectly readable.
Huh. Because I work near a landfill, and, you know, there's always interesting smells depending on what they're doing. But they do turn they have these big trucks that turn the earth and move it, and I was assumed that they were doing some sort of composting, because sometimes it does smell like hay or, you know, green
material. It
does
have a lot more, although there's a lot of stuff that happens with, like, wood chips are in a wood material, and lawn clippings go into a different section than others. So... maybe it's time for us to do a show on waste reclamation. But
right. Speaking of waste, no.
But when we talk about the adverse effects that can come from, you know, the unintended consequences from having large materials and trying to convert them to other materials, and their effect on climate, for example, it reminds me of a story that I came across, which was that some researchers have... Well, we have the IPCC, which had their 2007 report that's been so famous and so contentious in the media of the last few years, talking about how, yes, global warming is happening, and yes, it's man-made. And there's been hand-wringing about whether or not that was everyone, or who, like, took their name off of it, or who didn't believe in it, or how much consensus there actually is, and what their methodology was like. In recent years, we've had, or recent months, I should say, we've had reports come out from someone saying, okay, that's been funded by the Koch Foundation, one of the big critics of global warming theory.
Is that KOCH and not
right.
COKE?
Right.
Okay.
And one of the big leaders in terms of the it's not caused by humans, you know, issue, and that it's probably not warming. You went back through all the data and found out, oh, well, still not ready to say about human cause, but global climate change is happening. We look through the data and they're right. But people still have the issue of, like, but their methodology is all wrong, and they're trying to look at temperature trends from the deep ocean or lower atmosphere with modeling, and I don't know if we can... really derive from that. Well, the latest IPCC report shows climate models with and without the effect of greenhouse gases to illustrate the temperatures, you know, would be stable without human involvement. But a new study published by researchers at the Institute for Atmospheric and Climate Science at ETH in Switzerland directly examine Earth's energy balance instead. In other words, shortwave radiation from the sun, outgoing long wave radiation from the Earth, checking the imbalance or the balance between those, like how much heat is coming in, how much is leaving. And they came up with exactly the same answer that the IPCC did with a different methodology.
Oh, wow.
And when you say the same answer, you mean as the original study where, yes, global warming is happening, but we can't prove whether it's human involvement?
Looking at the trends for heating and seeing the effect of human interaction, like seeing how much the sun gives off and how much it comes back, how much heat gives off, and then compare that with your how much heat you're actually seeing, and that's going to be the difference. Because in general, no one else creates that much heat except us.
Whoops.
Whoops. And just to be clear, when I talk about shortwave radiation versus longwave radiation, the sun is very hot. And light waves and heat radiation is at a very high frequency when you have a very high temperature. So think of ultraviolet light is a shorter wavelength than infrared, which is a longer wavelength. You're going up infrared up further and further and further and further into like gamma rays and the like. And that's what we're getting from the sun. Although a lot of that upper range is getting filtered out. It hits the Earth, warms the Earth, and the Earth gives off heat again. But the Earth is much cooler than the sun.
Totally.
So that radiated heat ends up being a much longer wavelength. Just a little...
Thanks for the background.
Yeah, little tip from my classes in meteorology. And by classes, I mean that one class.
Right. It all proved useful. Now we know. Thanks for the Cliff Notes version. Well, for people that want to get off the planet because they don't want to fix it, I have one when you're done.
Okay. GeekSpeak on KOSB is supported by Henry J. Ramirez, DDS in Santa Cruz, specializing in handcrafted dentistry from start to finish using digital technology for less radiation and offering one-appointment crowns and veneers. Information is at RamirezDDS.com. And KUSP co-sponsors the Santa Cruz Ballet Theater production of The Nutcracker. The show includes a 55-piece orchestra conducted by John Larry Granger December 16th, 17th, and 18th at the Santa Cruz Civic Auditorium. Information and tickets are available at santacruztickets.com. GeekSpeak on KUSP is supported by Monterey County Atheists, celebrating secular values, reason, and free thinking at their holiday season gathering, December 19th, 7 p.m. at Gianni Pizza in Monterey. Reservations online at meetup.com/MCAtheists or an online search for Monterey County Atheists. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. I'm your host, Miles Elam. Does anybody have a geek bit that they want to share?
I don't know.
Well, in that case, I will do the geek bit for the day. And that geek bit is, well, pretty geeky. Ooh. Unicode.
Uh-oh.
Who knows what Unicode is?
Ooh. It's the code unicorn?
Unicode is an attempt by industry to make a unified character standard so that everyone, if they put in the character code for the hiragana character ka, for example.
What?
A Japanese phonetic alphabet, ka is a letter. Anyway.
Okay.
That it will be read as that same letter on multiple systems. So there, it's an agreement on, you know, for example, let's see, capital A is 65, you know, capital B is 66, and and go on down the chain for every single character of every known human language and any way of conveying information, including icons and, you know, hearts or, you know, things like that. Anything that's a written form to convey an idea.
So a heart that's like made from, you know, like a less than sign and a three?
No, an actual heart character.
Like ASCII, okay.
Well, it's not ASCII. ASCII is just a 128 character.
So this is more just like wingdings or something? I mean, just like little fonts that have icons and stuff?
Yes.
Okay.
And there's an actual code for them, including a white heart. In other words, a heart that has the outline, and another one that's a filled-in heart. A black heart.
A black heart.
One of the dilemmas that I've always come across with regard to the web, and a lot of people have come across whenever trying to do international characters, something comes to mind, for example, where folks on Windows are trying to make an E with an acute accent, the accent going, you know, heading up, or a grave accent heading down, or a circumflex, the little peak roof hat, you know, the umlaut, the two dots over a U, you know, or an O. And so I came across this website called shapecatcher.com. And what it does, it has a draw box. It allows you to draw with a mouse or some other pointing device, or I'm presuming also a touch device. You to draw the character that you're interested in, and then it will spit out all the characters that it could be like. You know, the better drawer you are, the fewer possibilities it is. The worse a drawer you are, the more possibilities it says, well, it could be this, it could be that, you know, it could be a heart, it could be an A, I don't know. But it allows you to find that character font because, I mean, Unicode has, I'm trying to remember what the number is, something on the order of 100,000 characters, 150,000 characters.
That's a lot of character.
That's a lot of code pages to go through to try to figure out what is the code for that one character. This is a great shortcut to be able to... Oh, I'm sorry.
109,000?
Yeah, actually, I take it back. Unfortunately, this does not support Japanese, Korean, and Chinese characters.
But that everything else? Shame.
But it does support 10,877 other Unicode characters, which tells you how many Japanese, Korean, and Chinese characters are there, including the Chinese simplified and Chinese traditional, and Japanese katakana, hiragana, kanji.
Kanji.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I think you need to get on that project, Miles.
Oh, I think they're doing a good enough job without me. But if all you need to do is find out how to make that heart character, or if you want to know the character code for an O with an umlaut over it, check out shapecatcher.com.
Excellent.
So you had a follow-up on the... Oh, I'm sorry. Just to let you know, we are taking calls today. The phone numbers here are 800-655-5877. Or you can call, if you're locally in the area, area code 831-476-2800. And be a part of the conversation. Ask us some questions. We should be able to cover a lot of items with the talent available in the audience today.
Our geek quotient.
Including probably if you had some questions about pet care.
The mystery guest.
So, Lindsay, moving on with your story, climate change.
You're talking about, you know, global warming. And
yes.
Me, I'd rather we fix it. But, you know, some people are just looking to the skies and...
And remember, we should actually call it global climate change because some areas, even though in aggregate the globe is warming, some areas will get colder and some areas will get hotter, some areas will get wetter, some areas will get drier because of messing with the heat conduction systems or transfer systems within the Earth.
So the cold people will feel left out if we say global warming, so global climate change.
Yes.
All right. You know, if you just want to scrap the project and move out into space, this will be exciting for you. The commercial venture SpaceX is set to send its Dragon space capsule to dock with the International Space Station on February 7th. And if all goes well, they're likely to win a $1.6 billion contract with NASA to haul cargo and astronauts back and forth to the space station in 12 separate flights. So we're one step closer. SpaceX was the first private company to put spacecraft into Earth's orbit and have it return intact, and that was last December. And up to that point, only five countries and one intergovernmental agency had been able to launch a spacecraft and have it successfully orbit and re-enter the atmosphere. And if the capsule docks successfully, SpaceX will be even more exclusive club with U.S., Russia, Japan, and the European Space Agency. So we'll see how that goes. They have a good video posted up on the site of the December launch if you want to get an idea of what it'll look like.
Yeah, and for those who want to know more about SpaceX, I highly recommend you learn about it. Go to Wikipedia or just look up Google search. You'll see a lot of coverage about it. Those flights were very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
One, they had to have two flights within a two-week period, I think it was, in order to get the prize.
I think so.
But in addition to that, they were not for the faint of heart.
No.
I remember hearing stories about it goes up and then basically the guy lost control because the air is so thin or practically non-existent.
Mm-hmm.
And so the craft was tumbling and then he had to recover.
Oh, wow.
So he made the vertical ascent, but at the same time, you have to be a very good pilot to handle that.
Interesting. I didn't know about that part. I have to go look it up.
Yeah, and check out the owner of SpaceX as well, Elon Musk. He was used as inspiration for the new Iron Man movies, and his goal is actually, I've read somewhere, that his goal is to live out his life in Mars, to be the first human to make it out there.
Interesting. Wow. I didn't know that.
Well, we do have a call. We have Mark from Salinas. You have a question about 3D printing?
Hi. There was an article on NPR this morning about a library, and I don't know where, someplace back east, that includes 3D lithography in their things you can use at the library, along with some other tools.
Yeah, absolutely. That's actually the article that that I found that inspired the little piece I talked about on 3D printing. And
it's quite an amazing technology. And I've always thought it would be a natural thing to the action figure industry. I'm looking at
good point.
I'm looking at a little doll that I have, an action figure of Mr. Spock, and the only thing that looks Vulcan about him at all is his ears, and it doesn't really look like Spock. But if they did a photograph of Mr. Spock, you know, taking one of those cameras that rotates around the person's head, there's no reason they couldn't come up with an action figure that looked just like him.
Mm-hmm.
We'd have to, you know, then we could get away with all these or give up all these poor imitations that we have.
Well, it is always that cost-benefit analysis to see. The more complex or ornate you make the figure, the harder it is to have good quality control on it. So that's why a lot of them end up being those rounded edges and nondescript features. Not to mention reuse of characters a lot of times so that you don't have to do a new mold for it. But it would be great for those one-offs or those very small runs where someone is a very much an enthusiast or an artist. And
I would think once you plugged it into the printer, you know, it would make so many copies or as many copies as you needed to achieve economic viability.
Well, I was thinking more in terms of economy of scale. If you need to make thousands or millions of them, it's almost always going to be more efficient to have it be with a big outfit that always does this. But for smaller runs, it makes a lot more sense to at least do the prototype in your own home.
And this will allow, like, you know, any enthusiast or artist, you know, some Trekkie out there to, you know, make his own and email it to a friend. And maybe it goes viral, you know, just by people sending it around.
That has been going around, actually. People have been making models that can be made with these 3D printers and sharing them out on the net, putting them on websites for people to download and the like.
I just think there's no excuse for Mattel to put out action figures that don't look like the character they're trying to.
Yeah, and now they'll have to compete with, you know, the enthusiasts. That'll be the interesting thing, is these mass market guys are going to have to compete with, you know, someone sitting at home with a 3D printer trying stuff out.
Yeah, I was actually thinking of billions of excuses that Mattel has done this over the years. But, you know, people are willing to pay for it. But, yes, you're absolutely right. If you have an option for people to be those small entrepreneurs or those one-offs, the things that aren't popular enough for a million action figure run, it will make the space a lot more interesting.
And I talked to somebody once who had one of these, and she had bought the metal type.
Oh, wow.
And what she really liked about it was that she could design chess pieces and then manufacture them at any size that she wanted. She could scale them down, and they would be exactly the same image. Whatever size she printed it at.
And chess pieces are a great example. That's something that you want to make, you want to have 10 different sets of that are all a little bit different.
Oh, yeah.
Or at least some of us that are
high quality.
Collectors. But not the filler.
Yeah, you can make your own Star Trek chess set.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah.
Radios and everything.
Okay, thanks, guys. I'll listen on the radio.
All right, thanks.
Thank you.
And the phone lines are still open if you want to call in, 831-476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. So who has the next story? Is it Jordan? I believe you're up next.
Sure, yeah. So the next in the run of startups to go for the IPO is going to be Zynga. They'll be coming up here this week. By Friday, you'll be able to purchase Zynga stock under the tracker Zynga without a Y, just Z-N-G-A.
So who are Zynga, for those who are not on Facebook?
indeed. Yep, Zynga pretty much popularized pixel crack, as I like to call it, which is little bits of virtual items that people pay real money for, and they use Facebook to spread their games and get people into these worlds. Games you've probably heard of, like Farmville and Cityville.
And Mafia Wars.
Mafia Wars, that's a big one, yeah. And they were just wildly successful. Actually, I made a small web-based game just before they started making theirs, and unfortunately, I missed all the good trends that they taught the whole community. They pretty much, you know, showed everyone how to do this right and how to make money off of it. And now they're going to be looking to raise $1.15 billion, which would be the largest IPO from a U.S. internet company since Google in 2004.
Wow. Yeah.
Fun fact, Zynga has always taken the position that innovation is overrated. Take what you know already works and get it out very fast.
Apparently it works.
Yeah, they've made a lot of money with that premise.
Hmm. Well, I think they did have one good innovative moment there, and then they just kind of used it over and over and over.
Sorry, what
over
was that innovative moment? No, seriously, what was that innovative moment?
Oh, it's on.
just the initial one. It's just how to monetize it, you know, like how to make it viral and how to monetize it. They did every little thing right, you know, with Farmville initially. I mean, who did something like Farmville before them?
Yeah.
And the monetization, they tied it in. There's a lot of psychology to it. There's a lot of conditioning. You know, Farmville.
Well, who did something like Farmville? That's, you know, The Sims. People going through the right. simulations, or Civilization, for that matter, going even further back.
Sure. And how much money did they make off of it?
Yes, a whole lot. That's the thing, though. They were the first. Zynga was not. But they executed very quickly.
Well, so their innovation was how they applied it to the internet. You know, I loved The Sims and SimCity, at least. I didn't really get into The Sims personally, but those were very interesting life simulations. I feel like Zynga took those principles and, you know, put it on the internet where they could get people checking in regularly. Hey, if you don't come check in your crops in this amount of time. I mean, I have a friend who would literally plant crops that she'd have to harvest over a long duration when she was going on vacation, right? She'd plant crops that were like shorter durations when she was around, and then she's going to go on vacation. Oh, I'm going to plant something I can come back. Like, literally planned her life around growing this little garden. So they really just engaged people in a dramatic way, and I think they taught the community a lot about how to market, monetize, and addict people to
online
things.
You know who really
things.
Started that? Was those people that had those keychain pets that you had to feed.
Oh, the what are they called? The Tamagotchi? Or?
I don't remember the name.
It's the same thing. That pressure of, oh my gosh, something's going to die if I don't maintain it.
Yeah. Digipets?
Yeah, I think it was something like that. Digipets.
No, there was another. I mean, there was
one before that.
Yeah, variations on a theme. And the really crazy thing I find is that I and my partner know about someone who has a farm, who has livestock,
a real farm,
a real farm, and she spends all day playing Farmville. It's astounding to us. Like, why would you need to play this game? You have it outside your house. Like, you.
Yeah.
What'd you call it? Pixel crack?
Pixel crack.
Pixel crack. Yeah.
That's what made my business partner call it. We're making online games because that's what they taught us. You know, we didn't make any money off of our. We made some off our first game, and then we watched Zynga and we went, oh, pixel crack. I see what they're doing.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have another call. Ben from San Jose. Hello, you're on GeekSpeak.
Hi, good day.
Hi.
My name's Ben. The question is about the directional antenna, basically, to help my aged mother-in-law get her Wi-Fi from her senior center about a block and a half away down to her house. This is a question she keeps asking me every Christmas when we show up for a few weeks to do house maintenance and such. And I'm no techno geek. I don't know if these products exist. I don't have an answer for her.
Well, one and a half blocks, first of all, is it line of sight?
It is with a tree, one tree in the way over by the source.
Okay. And can you get signal?
Down.
Yeah, can you get signal when you're walking with a laptop outside?
Yes.
Walking on the street.
I walked the course with her. We put her in a little wheelchair and take her down there. And we're good with the signal to about, 200 feet away from the senior center.
Okay. So first I want to preface with, the senior center will either have to give permission to do this, and or also the ISP that they're getting coverage through should be allowing this. So there may be some legal implications, but I'm not going to talk about that because, one, I'm not a lawyer, and two, it's just so darn fun to hack stuff like this.
Is this considered hack? This is basically on the fringe of legality.
Well,
this is a question she asked of me.
Not if she gets permission.
Right.
It's a great
ask
area.
Someone at the Senior Citizen Center what they think of it, and if they're fine with it, then you're kind of off the hook.
Well, they're cool with apparently when the center's open, she can use it. When they close, they turn the system off.
And, okay, if they're fine with it, then I think she should be
It's meant for public access for all the seniors and such that use the system. Everybody's got their own little password.
Okay, well, there are a couple of things you can do, and they range from expensive to less expensive.
Okay.
One is that you can get a Wi-Fi repeater that connects up to a directional antenna.
Well, that's what, okay.
And
that's
you can pay for these antennas. And you can also make what's known as a Yagi antenna. So that would be, you can find instructions for this on the internet where you take an old Pringles can.
Y-A-G-I?
Y-A-A-G-I, I think it is.
Yagi, I've heard the term, okay.
Although it may be Y-A-G-I, I can't remember. This, it turns out, ends up being a reasonably good directional antenna, and it may take you 1.5 blocks. Are these 1.5 city blocks, or are these 1.5...
No, this is city blocks. This is about 12 to 1,400 feet.
Okay. That shouldn't require that sensitive an antenna, then, as long as it's directional. Another option, something that I have done in the past to get about a quarter mile, I guess, is I've taken a old DirecTV satellite dish, and then I put my Wi-Fi access point at the focal point for that dish.
Okay.
In other words, removing the normal...
Well, I've got one of these ancient old HBO dishes that you used to be able to use when they were microwaved around the valley.
Mm-hmm.
And she kept saying, can't you do that for me now, basically. Maybe.
The idea behind these antennas is that you're focusing the signal from a specific source.
Right.
It's the same idea behind a telescope or anything else. You're taking a lot of light and you're focusing it to a small point so that you can, you know, so it's amplified.
I just didn't know a parabolic situation would work in this instance.
That's actually what directional antennas are, is oftentimes a parabolic lens. Parabolic reflector, I should say, not a lens, sorry. Although a Yagi is a slightly different thing, but anyway, not important.
Technically fascinating, okay.
But there are instructions online, and there are even people who have made YouTube videos where they describe how to make a Yagi antenna from a Pringles can, where they talk about, you know, setting up dishes.
This sounds like a kind of a gray area activity, so I doubt there's any real commercial service available where somebody could come in and install an antenna and hook this up for us and provide the hardware and such.
I actually do know a site you could check out, ubnt.com, Ubiquity Networks, and they've got kind of a whole range of stuff from scalable Wi-Fi. Their scalable Wi-Fi only goes every 500 feet, so that might not be enough. They're just these little simple base stations that can repeat each other. But they have a bunch of others, including dishes and antennas.
I'd like to basically take myself out of the loop and just say, here, this, call this person, he'll set you up.
Yep.
That's kind of the moment I'd like to be in.
Yeah, check out ubnt.com. Have them give him a call. They've got a whole range of solutions for you.
Well, so it does exist. So I'm not actually, the easy answer I was going to get is that it doesn't exist. Sorry, you're stuck with the landline, but it sounds
this technology is actually blowing up. This is an area where this stuff's getting a lot cheaper, even over the last couple of years. I think even...
Well, that's fascinating. Okay.
Yeah, it's a cool
And
area.
They probably would know the legal aspects of it better than we would.
Mm-hmm. That would be another thing I'd like to ask. Yeah, just make sure everything's squeaky clean.
Yep. All right, thank you for the call.
Thank you, guys.
All right, take care.
Good day.
And it looks like we have another call on line 3, although I don't see anything lit up, so maybe it hasn't been transferred yet. At any rate, while we're waiting, this is merely an off-air question. This is Tony, locally from the area. He's talking about the fact that there is, in Santa Cruz and other places, the Ham Radio Society. Ham radio being basically in exchange for being emergency responders, and they have helped out in either earthquake situations here in Santa Cruz, tsunami situations in Japan, things like that, flood situations in Philippines, I know it came into play. So personal shortwave radio. And that group is very adept at figuring out how to get signal in adverse conditions or how to extend a weak signal over a long period of over a long distance. So I'd highly recommend checking out your local ham radio society for information on that as well.
Good tip.
And do we have enough time for another story? Yes, we do.
Can I talk about Facebook a little bit?
Yes, you may.
So have you looked at your others messages? If you go under messages on the left-hand pane in your Facebook page, you can click on others, but it doesn't work when you click on the top icon. There are messages in there that Facebook filters out, thinking that they're unimportant, and sometimes they aren't unimportant. I looked through and I had messages back from like May and June that people had sent me thinking I was rude and not replying back to them because they were filtered out. So go check it out.
Oh, a spam filter for your Facebook, and the spam filter is not as accurate as we'd like sometimes.
Sometimes, yeah. And Google Plus does facial recognition now. So if you upload images, it's going to prompt you to turn on the auto tagging. And if you turn it on, it looks through yours and others' images trying to tag you. But people can untag themselves if they want.
And this one is opt-in as opposed to Facebook's attempt, which was opt-out.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Also, another recommendation for wireless, we have Bill from Santa Cruz recommending Wilderness Wireless. It's a Watsonville company. So yet another resource out there for people to try if they're trying to do this type of thing. And I still do recommend trying it yourself because it is a fun and learning. It is a learning experience. I'm really glad that I did it myself, even if I don't do it on a regular basis. Okay, we are coming up on the end of the show. I do want to thank our guests, Jordan Hart and Lindsay Lonnie, for being on the air with me. Thank you very much, geeks.
It's been a pleasure.
And once again, today's theme was by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence, and we thank the Puppet Master for its use, the Puppet Master from the TV show Heroes. And this is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz. We're streaming and podcasting at KUSP.org. Anybody have a last little tidbit they want to leave with the audience? Some little bit of geek knowledge, a little bit of geek trivia to wow us?
Trivia? I don't know if I have trivia. I know that online I found a way to make a DIY pony that breathes fire, so I can post a link to that. But other than that, I don't have trivia.
That works.
And because we're going to help people out with our TLAs, what is DIY?
Do it yourself.
Okay.
It's
Wait,
a kit.
What are TLAs?
3-letter acronyms.
I actually didn't know is the funny part.
Excellent.
And when you go out to a store and you go to Best Buy, have some fun with the people that work there or a similar place. Does this wireless gateway come with – does it have LFR support? Or I'm sorry, LRF support?
What's LRF?
I don't know. Does it have support for little rubber feet? At the bottom, little non-stick feet, or the little feet that are stick, actually. They're very stick. It's supposed to be non-stick.
LRF.
Yeah. And make sure when you give them the meaning, you say it in a way like, what, you didn't know what LRF was? I mean, come on.
And then you try to find another store that you'll be welcome at to shop.
Yes.
Make sure it's a place that you either have friends at or you're not worried that you won't be friends or welcome at it in the future.
Well, so just do it at Best Buy, then go to Fry's and get what you need.